Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. This is the Reason TV talk show with my co-host, Michael C. Moynihan, and our guest today, John Basil Utley, the subject of a great documentary called Return to the Gulag, and a regular contributor to the American Conservative and other publications, and Michael Munger, the Libertarian candidate for governor in North Carolina and the chairman of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Welcome, gents. Michael, first off, the Duke lacrosse team was guilty of something, weren't they?
Probably an indiscretion. Those parties are more common than I think many people would like to admit. And they may have been guilty of being rude.
Okay. Now, you did extremely well in your bid for the State House, right?
Well, I did well enough in my bid for the governor of North Carolina in order for us to retain ballot access, which is the first time we've been able to do that. I got 2% or 120,000 votes, but it was actually pretty close because of the Obama tsunami.
Yes. So that's, if it hadn't been for Obama, you'd be in a runoff right now. What were your goals in running? Because and you know, generally speaking, across the country, I mean, you were held up as the best LP candidate out there.
Well, in order to get on the ballot, we had to get like 110,000 signatures. So that required $250,000 of money and volunteer time, and that meant that we had poured all our money down a rat hole. So as of May, we had to start from zero. So my goal was to get the 2% that was required for ballot access and to try to maximize what politicians call earned media. It's just chances for the media to talk to us. For some reason, it kind of took off in North Carolina, where I got quite a bit of attention. I think part of the reason was the other candidates were so boring. They were uniquely ill-qualified.
What were the issues that resonated the most with Tar Heel voters?
Well, it helped me, in a sense, that the Speaker of our House had been publicly led away in handcuffs just 6 months before. There have been a lot of corruption scandals. North Carolina is not really subject to this kind of corruption. Normally, our corruption has been of the repaving roads a little more often and writing sweetheart contracts, but they actually get delivered. There was theft on a scale that had not really been seen before. So I talked about education, about roads, and about capital punishment, and those were three issues that people really cared about.
What was your position on capital punishment?
I was against the state being able to murder a helpless, unarmed citizen who was entirely in their control.
But private people, that's fine?
Well, as long as they're armed, yeah.
Okay, all right, sure.
Make it, and give them three steps. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, fair's fair. John, talk a little bit about Return to the Gulag.
Well, it's a documentary we did about the story of my father, who was a Russian. I was born in Moscow. My father was arrested in 1936, taken away by the secret police. They came at 2 in the morning, and my mother never heard the charges. She never saw him again. She got out of Russia because she was English and had me on her passport. And we did a documentary about finding the documents, what happened to my father.
Explain a bit. Your mother was Frieda Utley, the well-known journalist in England, later well-known anti-communist journalist in the United States. How did she end up in Moscow?
She had worked in London, and she was active with the British trade unions, and had been sent to Russia with a trade union delegation. And she met my father when he was with the Russian government trade mission in London. And they fell in love and first went to Japan when he was with the Russian embassy in Japan, a trade expert or trade counselor. And then went back in 1929 to live in Moscow and until he was arrested.
So he was in Moscow for seven years total.
During the 30s, this was the 30s, the terrible period of the purges and the collectivization of the peasantry and all that.
And so how did you find out what had become of your father? I know after 1991, it was still notoriously difficult to get into Russian archives. There was a small window of about 2 years where they were allowing people in. How did you go about that?
A Russian professor here in America, refugee, suggested he could find, now, at that time, you could go and get the documents. Mm-hmm. And they have, what's interesting in Russia is they kept the files from way, way back, all these files. They're like Germans, if you will. Everything is documented and filed. And when they were open to the public, you could go and request information. And we have in our documentary a place in Russia. There's a man, Rogachev, who's published books. They're thick books with the names of every prisoner and what happened. There's a record with the staff and volunteers. They go through the records. That's Memorial in Russia, a group of volunteers. And they've published thick books with the names of all the people. It's amazing, the record.
So it's kind of like the Book of Martyrs that came out in England at various points, of just lists of people, what they were charged with and what happened to them.
A little two sentences on what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's interesting, I think one of the things interested us most is the legality of it. Mm-hmm. Everything they did, there was a paper record. They'd have a little trial with two or three, usually, police officers, would try everybody. They would have a complete, you can't call it judicial, but the records were always there.
It was important that they could be given a fair trial before they were executed.
Well,
or after.
But the trial was like finishing trades
at the end
you have
of
a
the
record.
Day.
You know?
And there's a movie that came out in Russian, called The Czechist. The Cheka was the first secret police in the 1920s. And there's a scene in the movie where a guard has raped one of the women prisoners. And he says to his officer, but she's going to be executed in a few days anyway. What difference does it make? And they said, no. And they had a little trial, and he was sent before a firing squad, the guard. So there was a methodical thing. It's more than we would imagine.
Right. Michael, what's your academic specialty?
Well, I'm the editor of a journal called Public Choice. I'm a past president of the Public Choice Society. My PhD is in economics, and so a lot of the work that I do is between economics and political science. I study regulation and congressional policy.
How did you get interested in that field? And public choice economics is almost it's almost inherently libertarian, isn't it? It's certainly suspicious of state power and the ability of any agency to really regulate any kind of interest.
But both the public choice school and the Chicago school, I think, are in some ways just skeptical of concentrations of power. Mm-hmm. The idea behind public choice economics is that most regulation is either going to be written or changed to benefit the industry that it's supposed to be regulated. Now, whether that you say that the power is government or the power is corporation, the point is regulation is generally going to have the opposite of the intended effect.
Right, or the explicit effect.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you, though. Built into, you were telling me earlier that you had just celebrated the Bill of Rights Day. The Constitution is typically held up as a great decentralist document, that it tries to have checks and balances, spread power around. But embedded in the Constitution was a decentralist principle that benefited the slave power. So what are we left with? If centralization is bad and decentralization often is a cover for even more egregious abuses of human rights, where are we left in terms of political documents?
Well, as a libertarian, I find the idea of states' rights to be an odd sort of concept. I think the principle that I would advocate is anything that moves power closer to the individual is probably better. Problem is that the states abuse those rights in a very particular way.
Right.
And in Federalist 51, James Madison talked about the necessity of having larger majorities. So there's always a tension between allowing states to decide where majorities can, well, in that small a democracy, majority rule is just two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a small state be able to decide those things is always going to oppress majorities.
Right.
It's relying on government at all that's the problem, whether it be state or federal.
How do we get from here to there? Away from government power.
Many parts of the Bill of Rights, it seemed to me, and it struck me yesterday on reading them. We stood in a group in Charlottesville and read them aloud, and people stopped by. It struck me how the Second and Tenth had been ignored quite a lot, although somebody apparently in an old file in the Supreme Court building rediscovered the Second.
Mm-hmm.
But they haven't rediscovered the Tenth, which said that anything that's not specifically enumerated belongs to the states or to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas, in fact, the federal government has taken most of those powers to itself.
Mm.
So I think that just having countervailing power, having the states and the federal government fight about it, is how we get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's settled. The federal government has all these powers.
Right. We're going to take a break.
The government bailed out Wall Street executives, homeowners, and struggling auto companies. But what about the rest of America?
I thought it would be a great way to save for our daughter's college fund.
You only get married once, so I threw myself a Sex and the City bachelorette party and bought Manolos for all of my bridesmaids. All 12 of them.
This African businessman sent me an email over the internet to my work account saying that he had an exciting business opportunity for the both of us. He said his name was Okunwe from Nigeria. In trade, man. It is a money sucker. I thought Susan Lucci was a lock for another daytime Emmy. It'd been years. All I had to do was wire him $50,000 into an American account, and then I'd get 60% of the inheritance. I didn't think twice about giving him my soche.
And then I had to fulfill one of my dreams as a bride and have Cavehead at my bachelorette party, which was amazing. I still get chills from it, but that was another 30 grand, which is actually a pretty good deal because he usually costs more.
To make up for it, I quit my job and entered the World Series of Poker, but an injury prevented me from competing. A hangover is an injury. Turns out it was a scam.
Where's my bailout?
Where's my bailout?
So, where's my bailout?
Contact your congressional representatives and ask them, where's my bailout? Because all Americans should be protected from their own stupidity.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. This is the Reason TV talk show with my co-host, Michael C. Moynihan. Our guest, John Basil Utley, journalist and subject of the stunning documentary Return to the Gulag, and Michael Munger, head of the political science department at Duke University and a Libertarian Party candidate for governor in North Carolina. Let's talk about some current events. John, how do you feel about the bailout mania that is gripping this nation? You know, like the Cobra Clutch, an old wrestler.
I come as a refugee to America. I came on a Dutch ship. It was sunk on the next trip. It was second to last trip.
Just a coincidence.
And, well, timing is everything. And as a child of the communist experience, I was born in Russia, I'm very focused on the world depression, if you will. And when it seemed that capitalism didn't work, and out of the depression came communism and Nazism, and a lot of that came from the wrong policies of the Federal Reserve that exacerbated the depression, the crash in 29.
I mean, fascism was firmly in place in Italy, Nazism in Germany.
But they wouldn't have become the great powers that they came except for the collapse of capitalism, world trade. And because of that, in answer to the question today, I'm probably more focused on don't let the crash get out of hand.
But how do you do that without making it worse? I mean, where does it come down to saying, oh, we got to bail out Chrysler because of communism?
The money, first, the money the government spends isn't all spent, wasted, as people say. Those are credits and loans, and a lot of that comes back. And you want to keep the economy from snowballing downhill, with whatever it takes, I would say. And that might be $2 trillion, but that's not lost. It comes back.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? Well, Professor Munger.
There's two sources. I mean, predictably, I'm not such a fan. There's two sources of the money that we're spending. One is money that we're printing. Mm-hmm. We're actually creating new money from the Federal Reserve, and the other is from taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So when John says it's not wasted, that might be true, but I think of Bastiat's what is seen and what is not seen. You're taking it from people who aren't getting to spend it on something, and you're giving it to these other companies. So either you're taking it from future generations, because all deficits are tax increases in the future, or I'm not worried about the depression as much as I am Weimar Germany. I'm worried about overcorrecting and then hyperinflation.
And that's true. There's a threat of overcorrecting. Well, we know from the 80s when Reagan was in and Volcker, you know how to stop inflation.
Inflation was 15% then.
Okay. So let it go to 15, but save us now.
There were huge costs to squeezing that out.
Okay,
but the greater cost is ultimately the payoff is much better. I mean, you can't have 15% inflation or 10% unemployment forever, right?
Well,
Michael, you're buying a lot of wheelbarrows, right?
I am.
Betting on Weimar.
I'm buying a lot of Weimar money, too.
Yeah.
I got a loaf of bread for 16,000 Deutschmarks.
Just try to do that after the show.
You know, you joke about this. I was a student in Italy after the Second World War, and you had to take a bunch of paper. It was dirty, filthy, the paper money. And in America, I'd read, oh, the economy won't work. Well, it was working. Not well, but people had food. It's not
Talk about how you, was it in the 50s and 60s, you sold mutual funds to oil workers in throughout Latin America.
60s and 70s, okay. Yeah.
What did that teach you about capitalism?
Well, first, it taught me that as a salesman, people, the great majority are not stupid. People are ignorant, but not stupid. Mm-hmm. Democracy works in that sense, if you can inform people. And I saw the consequences in South America of small things that go wrong that they could never get off the ground in these economies.
What's an example of that?
Well, one was the tax rates. Mm-hmm. One was U.S. foreign aid, which was geared, we thought, to help them develop. We'd take lessons from our depression, which were totally irrelevant. Mm-hmm. A lot of the aid was counterproductive, did more damage. I mentioned on another time the Atlas Economic Research Foundation trying to use pro-market, free-market ideas to develop in these countries, etc.
How difficult is it to create a kind of rule of law? Because, I mean, that's part of the situation, right? You need to have a structure in place by which power can be, power at the very least, can change without a revolution.
Absolutely. We now, people used to say democracy. I think today the consensus is a rule of law first. And how do you make laws without legitimacy of law? It's a slow process. Mainly it's slow. It evolved in parts of Europe, and those are the lessons.
In Latin America now, you see obviously a big, not a big, but a pretty pronounced leftward drift with countries like Venezuela, Brazil, Bolivia,
even
Ecuador,
Chile.
Even Chile, who had its own sort of step backwards. What, you know, looking at Hernando de Soto and looking at Latin American economists who have been preaching markets, where have they gone wrong? Why is this shift happening now in Latin America?
You mentioned Hernando de Soto. His first book, one of the most interesting things, was he come to America and ask, why does it work here and not with us?
Exactly.
And he concluded people don't know why it works here. It's something I do think a lot about. I think we take for granted a government that works, that functions. Most countries don't have that, the corruption, the different reasons. Mm-hmm. The electoral system, one of the big things is the electoral system. When we promote democracy in the rest of the world, we don't promote our system, which is federal with limited powers of government. We just say, have a vote. And I've written about this, but it's for another day. The electoral system, and you have to say our traditions, but it's getting the right laws in place. And it can happen. The development, look at China, can be incredibly fast once the laws, the proper laws are in place.
How much of Latin America is, I mean, it's simply an artifact of Cold War politics and the fact that we weren't interested in exporting democracy. We were interested in exporting what we would consider stability, that we had, our bastard in place as opposed to a communist bastard.
And that's true, but not entirely. We were trying to do well. But we didn't know ourselves why our systems function.
And, I mean, it's the country's their fault. I mean, one of the problems with Latin America, and it's like the Middle East, where they're always looking outwards for explanations, or we and Americans are always willing to say we're the cause of everything good or bad in the world. Brazil has been screwed up for hundreds of years.
American advice has not always been good. When I was in these countries, the tax rates were astronomical. It wasn't until Jude Wanniski's great book, The Way the World Works, that even I saw that the tax rates were 60% in Bangladesh for over $2,000 of income was a 60% marginal rate. And U.S. advice did not focus on that. We just gave aid and aid. We never said you've got to have function. And rule of law, property rights, big, big.
Right.
And that's Hernando de Soto.
Yeah, that was
a big one. Michael, you said education was one of the big issues for you in your race. What is your basic education plan?
Well, it was pretty tepid sorts of changes. I just wanted to put power and choice and responsibility back in the hands of parents. And interestingly, I had more votes from African Americans than I did, a higher proportion of African Americans than from other citizens. And a lot of the reason was that some sort of choice for people that now don't have it, a voucher program, charter, something that gives them.
Where do you live?
I live in Wake County, near Raleigh.
Okay. And do you send your kids to the public school?
They go to public
school.
And
you're happy with them?
Very happy.
Yeah. Okay. And so, I mean, it's not even, you're talking about choice at a pretty abstract level, just where you can choose where to live.
I get to choose. Why shouldn't other people get to choose? Right. I'm rich.
Why doesn't that message carry more resonance?
Because if people will actually say this, if people make choices, some of them are going to make bad ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can't have that.
What was the reaction to your campaign in general from your colleagues at Duke, a university known for magazines like Social Text, which I think is out of Duke University?
Well,
right, Alan Sokol's favorite.
Social Text.
Let me say briefly.
Yeah.
Over 100 Duke professors contributed to my campaign.
Oh, really?
And can we read a list of them?
Yes.
Prop 8 supporters in California?
Only the ones over $200 are formally reported.
So so everyone donated $199
They were proud.
Yeah.
So I was the leftist in this race, you have to realize.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
In North Carolina, our Democrats are Republicans, and our Republicans are Taliban.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
What is the likelihood that libertarian ideas will have any kind of real purchase within the academy outside of possibly economics departments?
Well, in political science, it will, because it's a political theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the perspective on regulation is one that a lot of people haven't thought of. I have found a lot of people in the academy are actually at least interested.
Right.
So having that perspective represented is important. And at Duke, I have to give credit, they don't say, well, we don't want to hear it. They'll say, well, what do you think about this?
And, I mean, it's true that people like Gabriel Kolko and historians from the left have actually contributed a lot to a public choice understanding of regulation and government process.
In some ways, we share more with Marxists than we do the sort of traditional Harvard, there's monopoly everywhere approach.
Mm-hmm. What, John, very quickly as we wrap up, prospects for freedom, are we better off now than in the world, not just that your father was killed in, but say in your salad days when you were selling mutual funds in the 60s and 70s?
Yes, I think we're much better. Of course, you have to add the Internet and organizations like yours.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact that this kind of talk can get out, you can't imagine when it used to be just three networks that took their news from the Washington Post and New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that is an inner clock. Optimists see the bright side and pessimists see the dark.
And, you're pointing at Munger?
Michael, you have some children, right?
I have two boys.
Are you looking for, do they have better prospects than you? And if they do, why are we talking about libertarian ideas?
They have fine prospects so long as they have choice and the power to fully realize their human potential.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all libertarians ask, is the American dream for the whole world, for everyone, without having any sort of restrictions that prevent me from being able to make those choices and accept their consequences for good or ill.
We do want to see prosperity in the world. I was happy to see China or India getting better. You can see that billions of people in these last years have improved their lives wonderfully. The bright side before this crash. No.
And you don't care about that at all.
Of course I do. I'm a free trade zealot.
You're buying baby formula with added plastic?
Yeah, well, that's a different issue. I mean, I buy everything
they were out of the ones with lead.
That's right. So. Well, we're going to stop here today. Thanks for tuning in to the Reason TV Talk Show. I'm Nick Gillespie. My co-host is Michael C. Moynihan. And our guests today were John Basil Utley, subject of the excellent documentary Return to the Gulag, and Michael Munger of Duke's Political Science Department and the LP governor's race in North Carolina. Thanks very much.